From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll look back at Governor Walker's inaugural address yesterday and ahead at the coldest forecast of the year.
We are quite a bit below the normals. Average high should be around 28, 29 degrees. And so we have a legal right to bellyache about this. But in terms of, you know, like last year, oh, we've got nothing too bad to really complain about.
And there are fun things to do in Arctic weather. We'll find out just what they are. Plus, an advocate sees good things coming out of the local film community.
Over the last 7 years or so, I've been seeing it strengthen, maybe not necessarily grow in numbers, but the strength of the projects are becoming more and more interesting and more well-rounded and more original overall.
And author Mark Sloka joins us to share his novel of the late 60s called Brewster. Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Teich. Welcome to Tuesday. Thanks so much for being with us today. Scott Walker began his second term in office as governor of Wisconsin yesterday. The inauguration came 2 months after his comfortable margin of victory over challenger Mary Burke. Walker's Republican Party will have significant majorities in both the state assembly and Senate. His inaugural address itself was relatively short, but it reflected themes that he sounded in his victory address on election night. And like in that speech, Walker's Monday address sometimes spoke to an audience beyond the borders of his home state.
In contrast to the politicians along the Potomac, we get things done here in the Badger State. There is a clear contrast between Washington and Wisconsin. We have been good stewards of the taxpayers' money and lowered their tax burden as well. We've shown why the founders of this great nation looked to the states and not the federal government as the source of hope for this exceptional country. We will not let them down.
And as his Republican counterparts around the country have echoed, Walker took renewed aim at his goal of shrinking state government.
We will reduce the size and scope of government to match the will of the people. State agencies will be merged to make them more effective, more efficient, and more accountable to the public. We will continue to weed out waste, fraud, and abuse. Budgets will be set based on the taxpayers' ability to pay and not on the government's ability to spend.
While the speech did not go into the detail of a state of the state or a budget address, the governor did lay out the priorities he sees in the coming months, including his efforts to expand school choice programs.
We will help our fellow citizens, regardless of mobility or income, station or status in life, to achieve the education and skills needed to succeed in their chosen occupations. This will not only help fill the positions that are open today, but will build confidence in employers that they can create new jobs and find qualified workers to fill them. We will ensure that every child, regardless of background or birthright, has access to a quality education. For many, like my sons and me, it is a traditional public school. For others, it may be in a charter, a private, a virtual, or even a homeschool environment. Regardless, we will empower families to make the choice that is right for their sons and daughters.
And Governor Walker touched on the sectors he says he would most like to see grow during his second administration.
We will build the needed infrastructure to support a thriving economy, a transportation system to assist major industries like manufacturing, agriculture, forest products, and tourism is a key part of this infrastructure. So is broadband internet access to connect every part of the state to the global economy and cost-effective and reliable sources of power to fuel our growing economy. Overall, everyone in this state should have an opportunity to live their piece of the American dream right here in Wisconsin.
Excerpts from Governor Walker's second inaugural address yesterday in Madison. You can find additional coverage, including reaction from both sides of the aisle, at WUWM.com. While the gubernatorial inauguration got some attention in Wisconsin yesterday, the story that's on almost everyone's mind is the return of the snow and Arctic cold to the region. Cold weather was reported to be a contributing factor in the deaths of several people in the Milwaukee area in the past few days. The snow has caused numerous traffic accidents around the region, and temperatures have been falling below zero overnight. In fact, tomorrow's high temperature may only reach the zero marker. Mike Westendorf is a meteorologist and director of operations for Innovative Weather based at UW-Milwaukee, and he joins us to give us some perspective on the significant cold snap we find ourselves in. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good to be here.
And it's good to talk with you, although, as is often the case when we talk to you, it is about weather that has gone south. Maybe we'd like to go south with it. A little more snow to go along with some really cold temperatures this week.
That's right. Most of the area, we got spared the worst of it. Iowa was hit pretty hard. Illinois was hit pretty hard, 3 to 6, up to 8 inches of snow. But we don't have too much to cry about, especially since we've had barely any snow this year. But the big headline is, of course, going to be our temperatures, which will be quite chilly coming up for the rest of this week.
Well, and so it is the beginning of January, which is the winter, right in the middle of winter. What should we be expecting this time of year, and how much colder than usual is it?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe let's just take a quick walk down memory lane, because I don't know about you, but until we started going down this interview road, I was a little fuzzy. My whole recollection of all of last winter was horrible. Going back and I'm looking at the records, and so like last year, January 6th, the temperature was -4, the low was -13. So that seems to be about the way that I remember it. But January 13th, the temperature was at 44, the low is 27. We had a fair amount of snow in the month, but the real cold really didn't settle in until the end of the month, and then it stayed through the month of February for the most part, and off into March. We were well below the normals. So January last year, actually, for the better half of it, wasn't too bad. So to get this little bit of a cold shot, I think that, you know, it gives us a right to complain, because we are quite a bit below the normals. Average high should be around 28, 29 degrees. And so we have a legal right to bellyache about this. But in terms of, you know, like last year, we've got nothing too bad to really complain about.
Well, and this is obviously really cold weather, but I wonder if what makes it especially jarring is that it came on the heels of a December that essentially gave us a free pass as far as the winter was concerned.
That's exactly it. You are and are so right. I mean, you remember in November, we had that 10-day stretch. It was one of the coldest 10-day November stretches on record. You had to go back to the 1800s to find a colder stretch of 10 days in November. So this has been an interesting year so far, in that September had about a 2 to 3 week period that was well below the normals. October was fantastic. November was more like January. And then December rolled in and it was more like March. And now we're back to something that's, you know, at January, below zero temperatures in January. We come to kind of expect that. We do live in Wisconsin. We are a little tougher than that. But it is below the normals. And I suspect that based on some of the longer range models and their suggestions, it will probably be on the colder side for a while this month.
Well, and the term that got all the press last year was polar vortex. And I remember we talked about the significance of what was going on last year. Same phenomenon, or is this just a run-of-the-mill, really cold weather?
Well, you know, if you really want to get a great story, you talk to Dr. Paul Rober about the polar vortex. He cracks me up when he starts talking about this. He sent us an image around that showed the polar vortex on what wound up being the hottest day of the year in July, and, you know, back in the, you know, 20 years ago or whatever it was. The point being that the polar vortex is always there. There's always a cold core of polar air that's around. It's just a matter of where is it going to be and how long is it going to be. That was the thing that happened last year, is that it did not budge. Some of the reasons for that, one of the big ones that in hindsight was that there was a big area of low pressure that was stuck in the Gulf of Alaska and it just didn't move. And so it just kept shoving all the cold air right down into the northeastern part of the country, including us here in the Great Lakes. That is not the case. This is an El Nino year. The subtropical jet has been more active. California has been getting some rainfall. And the pattern we've seen the flip-flops on a more regular basis. And at least El Nino does not mean this is how it's going to be, but there are some trends, and the trends generally are that in the Great Lakes, we tend to be, over a 3-month average, warmer than normal and a little drier than normal typically. And so my hunch is that this is probably going to be that 2 to 3 week cold snap in January, and it'll warm back up again, and it'll just kind of move on to more of a normal winter, if you will.
Well, at this point, you said the coldest weather is likely to hang on for a little while. Yet, what is the coldest we're likely to see it get this week?
This week, I think that the worst of the cold is more than likely going to be coming up into Thursday morning, Wednesday into Thursday. Wednesday, because that's the coldest core is going to be heading southward. And so morning temperatures as you get into Wednesday morning, similar to this morning, probably 5 to 10 below zero around the area. We then get very light winds expected to come back in Thursday morning, and with a fresh snow cover, that's where we have the better chance to see the actual temperatures into that minus 5 to minus 15 range. After that, we are going to stay cold probably through the upcoming weekend, but the signs are that this should break down into something more like normal as we get toward the latter part of the weekend and into next week as well.
Swimsuits for everyone.
Or polar plunge, whatever you want, you know, whatever floats your boat.
Well, let me ask you one more question, and it's about one of those weather phenomena that many people believe to be true, and it seems like it makes sense, but is snow at colder temperatures lighter and fluffier than snow when it is relatively warmer, or can you have a heavy snow when it's really cold?
Probably you get a little bit of a, it depends on the person that we're talking to. So for example, heavy snow might have to deal with how many inches of snow falls. So you look outside your window and there's 8 inches of snow, but when you step on it, it compacts down to about a quarter of an inch, you know? So some people would say that's a heavy snow. Other people would be like, no, that's not a very heavy snow. The matter is that in colder temperatures, the atmosphere is not capable of holding on to or retaining much moisture. And as a result, the snowflakes themselves tend to be of a lighter nature. And the snowfall, the moisture in that snowfall tends to be quite a bit lighter as well. So the overall impact, I think, is that for us, typically there, but depending on the atmospheric profile, you can get, instead of snowflakes, what they call dendrites or sticks of ice that fall. It still looks like a snowfall, but you get a much more compact snow. It tends to be lighter in terms of accumulation, but very, very icy. So yes, it's lighter. It kind of is in the eye of the beholder as far as who would argue that.
Mike Westendorf, thanks so much.
You bet.
Mike Westendorf is a meteorologist and director of operations for Innovative Weather at UW Milwaukee. You can find Innovative Weather's latest weather forecast at WUWM.com. The cold weather is dangerous, but it can also be fun. We'll talk about the lighter side of the cold with our outdoor adventure contributors when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Cold water made the news a couple of times in 2014. There was, of course, the Ice Bucket Challenge, in which millions of Americans dumped cold water on their heads in a stunt to raise awareness of the disease ALS. And months before that, it was a fun science experiment involving boiling water tossed into below zero air. The latter experiment and the current cold snap are what are on the minds of our outdoor adventure contributors, Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer, who have some other ideas, just as long as you promise to dress warmly. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Hey there.
So I remember last year, about the most fun that anybody had during the polar vortex, at least when they weren't hurting themselves doing it, was the idea of taking a pot of boiling water, tossing it up in 10 below zero temperatures and seeing the instant steam and snow and chaos that it turned into. That is not the only fun thing that you can do in the cold weather, is it?
That is not the only fun you can have, although I do admit I do that every winter. I get out there and I giggle and giggle. Oh, it's magic every time.
I want to go revisit the video I made of myself doing that.
No, the bubbles, okay, that's Ken's thing. He loves telling people people about the bubble.
Yeah, so if it's cold enough that you can do the water trick, actually take some bubbles out as well and blow the bubbles and watch them freeze, you know. And it's sometimes it's a little windy in the winter, right? You know, so we got to make sure you got a nice calm area, maybe back behind in the backyard. But they just freeze and they're like little crystals and they land and then they shatter. And oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful way to experience
it is pretty cool. And to see the kids, like, awe of how they're just, like, floating but frozen, it is really cool to see.
You forget how cold your toes are for a brief moment.
Yeah.
Well, and a close cousin of this is what you can do with balloons.
Yeah, so this has been – I've seen this all over Pinterest, and it's like ice balls or different variations of this. You take a balloon and you put water in it and you put food coloring in there. And then you set it out overnight. So once it freezes solid, you just snip the balloon away and you're left with these gorgeous balls of color. So, like, I've seen them, like, lining walkways. We will, like, put them in a circle and then have fun of doing something in the center. But it's just, like, such an easy activity. You just throw it outside and then it's like a little kid on Christmas morning. You, like, wake up and you, like, want to go and check your balls and see, you know, how they're doing.
Well, and it's funny because I was thinking about this. I almost envisioned that you were going to coat the balloon, you know, blow up a balloon with air, coat it with water, and freeze it that way.
Like paper mache, some reverse. That's brilliant. Let's try that.
But yeah, no, it's just like a water balloon, and then just adding a few drops of that food coloring. Food coloring in winter is a wonderful thing. Line up the food coloring.
It's the sidewalk chalk of winter.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is. Well, and along those lines, you make recommendations for snow painting.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, exactly. You take the food coloring out there. You can put it in a little spray bottle. You can get the painter and they'll dip and paint, you know. It's also a great way to decorate your snow people. So you build up and draw their little faces. You can so much potential. Winter is your canvas.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, it's just a spray bottle. So even if you don't have one, it's like a dollar. And, you know, go to the dollar store and grab one.
Well, and it's so much more colorful than just those big splotches of yellow on every snow pile on the corner.
That's right.
It is an improvement.
So when you're not tossing boiling water into the air, what are the other things that you've customarily done through the years? I know the idea of instant maple ice cream is a good one.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Make a little winter treat where you add some flavor to your snow and eat up. You know, one thing, it's just so simple. But every time I fall back, I make the snow angel. I watch the clouds float by. And I usually like to wait until a little later in the winter when those days are starting to get a little bit warmer and you can just soak up the sun rays. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Let the little bits of snow melt inside your clothes.
That's right.
Yeah, there's some good to winter.
Go inside, wring out your socks.
Right.
Well, that sets us up for a fun winter. Stacy, Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are our outdoor adventure contributors, the minds behind the website DestinationNature.net, and authors of the new book, The Truth About Nature, A Family's Guide to 144 Common Myths About the Great Outdoors. Another break now, and then the opportunities for and challenges faced by the growing Milwaukee film community. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. It has been 6 years since the Johnny Depp film Public Enemies saw a major movie studio use Milwaukee as a primary setting for a film. And with the short-lived tax credit for filmmakers here long gone, it may be a while before it happens again. But feature films are still being made here. The efforts are typically more grassroots, such as two films that showed at the Milwaukee Film Festival recently, The Surface, which starred Sean Astin, which was set on Lake Michigan and in Milwaukee was one, and the dramedy Serial Daters Anonymous was also filmed here. That film's largely local cast and crew included executive producer Sam Cosell, who is also an active advocate of bringing more film production to Milwaukee. His company, Film Freed, works to connect all the moving parts of the film industry here. Cosell tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about what his effort is up against.
I think the community is, I wouldn't necessarily call it small, but it is not large. It's growing significantly, and it's over the last 7 years or so, I've been seeing it strengthen, maybe not necessarily grow in numbers, but the strength of the projects are becoming more and more interesting and more well-rounded and more original overall. And so that's what I've been seeing, and definitely with the film festival this year was really, really excellent. I think that's putting us on an excellent course for the future.
It just seems to me, and I dabble in talking about film, but that the film community here is certainly not centralized, or there isn't one go-to place. Like in LA, of course, there's like it's the industry there, but here it seems a little disjointed and scattered. Is there any kind of coalescing going on that will make it easier, or will there at least maybe be a go-to place? I know your organization tries to do that. Is that something that's going to happen, do you think?
Yes, I think it's inevitable with the growing of the community. It's a necessity that happens. Otherwise, it kind of stays among friends. But I think a lot of the filmmakers know each other, but they do tend to work with the same people some of the time, which is not a bad thing. Most professional filmmakers kind of do that. But I do think what my company is trying to do is help out in that manner. So anytime anyone needs anything, we connect them with the right people or with the right locations and just stuff like that.
It seems to me maybe 20 years ago, like the landscape here was a lot of either small filmmakers or short films or documentaries. It's been there and it is there. But it seems like now with the advent of the film festival or a couple of film festivals that things are evolving and we're seeing a lot more local filmmakers or more local filmmakers doing feature-length projects or getting national attention. How are things progressing in maybe in the past 10, 20 years?
Yeah, people are more ambitious, and I think more people, more talented filmmakers are staying here and being able to grow that structure that allows them to create features, which does include working with kind of the same people, so you get into a rhythm. And that's why you see certain filmmakers work with the same people. It's not because they're like, it's not like it's high school and it's the lunch table thing. It's because that they're developing a method of working together that becomes smooth and honed as a whole. So be kind of coming a bigger, larger machine and just understanding how all the different cogs work. And like, I think that's why it seems like things are kind of scattered, but they're really not, because you have to think of these pockets of like filmmakers as single entities that are trying to achieve a larger goal and are cultivating that. And I'm definitely seeing more features being shot by even UWM students just in the last couple of years. When there was none going on, there's been one by Carol Brandt that's been featured in a couple of film festivals around here. And she was also in this last year's Milwaukee Film Festival with Give It Up for the Girl. And then Martin K. or Scott Carey, they are shooting a feature currently called Christopher Darling. And so the ambition level is raised, and that is the first step to kind of shooting for a greater community here in Milwaukee for film.
Now, you mentioned staying, or some of them staying here, implying mm-hmm. that people do leave. I mean, that's not unusual in the film world for people to go to L.A. or New York and pursue careers there. So it's not necessarily something that is a Milwaukee problem, if you will. But how is that structured these days? I mean, where people go to Hollywood because they want careers in film generally or to be actors. So what is it that Milwaukee offers that would allow people to stay?
I think it's that thing where they have been growing with a group of people. And going to LA is not a bad thing. It's a different community there. It's definitely oversaturated. And I think what's beneficial about being in Milwaukee is that, I've said this before, it's that we have untapped magic that's still about, you know, the mysticism sort of that surrounds movies and gets people excited, which is what makes it a little easier here and a little more exciting to do it here, because people kind of light up when you talk about being a filmmaker here. And if you talk about being a filmmaker in California, people just kind of glaze over and nod like, you know, like, oh, so you're an actor. what else do you do? Like, how do you make money? So California's weird. I got really sick of talking about filmmaking there. It's just so much about filmmaking that I kind of get really tired really fast. It's kind of, it turns into a 24-hour job when you're in California. You're always working it and you're always talking about projects. It didn't matter where I went. It would always kind of devolve into a conversation about movies. And I mean, it's good to go to that culture because it is still an epicenter of people and artists and filmmakers if you want to try to get into like the bigger stuff. But I think what's equally important is I know some Milwaukee filmmakers that kind of go out there, but they still remain connected with Milwaukee, or they, what I do with my friend Chris Emmons and Justin Lothrop, the people I did Serial Daters Anonymous with, which was at the festival. We try to bring projects back to Milwaukee. So they're kind of my LA liaisons, and we're always trying to get people and talk to different LA places about shooting in Milwaukee and the advantages of shooting Milwaukee. Even though we don't have incentives, we still have various ways, and we know the community here, and we know how we can save large productions money and sort of why it might be good to be here. But film incentives would also be a great help to our film community as well.
Film incentives meaning tax incentives.
Yes.
What has happened? We talked about this years ago, and yeah. The tax incentives went away. What exactly, maybe you can refresh our memories as to what that was. I mean, is there nothing really available now?
No, there's nothing available. The only thing available is kind of, if you go through me, you can kind of get donations that are tax deductible. So I have like a slight, tiny, tiny possible sort of advantage, tax advantage. But it's definitely not to the scope of what the tax incentives were. And I've heard numerous stories on why they failed and why they were taken away. And it was a lot of political jargon that I just didn't really care to listen to because I just know it's the right thing. And you can just see that if you look at all the different states that are doing it, they're thriving. They're having large, large productions coming out of Hollywood because Hollywood doesn't do movies in California really anymore. They do it in all these different states that have tax incentives.
Well, that's one side of film production. The other, I would say, how does it, maybe the local perspective on filmmakers, how, just because the film community is so not centralized, how does it work when filmmakers are trying to get local money for productions when they're competing against other local arts organizations that have a bigger profile or are better organized and just have a kind of a track record of raising money?
It's extremely difficult. Filmmaking in Milwaukee really doesn't get any money at all from any sort of foundations locally that I'm aware of that aren't documentary based. I mean, I've started to do a little bit. I've only been doing it a year, so it's been slow going and kind of a grind. Otherwise, most of the time it's just from Kickstarter, which is really just reaching out to friends and family and hitting them up for money. So I would say that any support is, to my knowledge, invisible to me currently. But that's just because we don't have that long history of, you know, theater and the arts here in Milwaukee. Filmmaking has just become much, much easier in the last few years because of the technology. And so it's still an emerging art form. So I'm not upset by this, and I don't think it's like we're getting a raw deal. I think we're just kind of up and coming finally and becoming more into the future of filmmaking because now you can get, you know, Hollywood caliber cameras for very, very cheap, and anyone can kind of do a Hollywood caliber movie. So I think it's just a newer art form in terms of being able to do broader cinematic feature-length films. And I think that's something that Milwaukee should hopefully be interested in because I like doing it.
Right. Well, besides the tax incentives that we don't have, what is it that Milwaukee can do that it isn't doing when you compare us to a city like Portland, for example, somewhere, a city that's more of our size that actually has more going? I mean, do we need to have a major filmmaker like they do kind of,
it would help,
you know, supporting the city's scene?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know Richard Linklater, who did Boyhood this year and numerous other great films. He founded the Austin Film Society. And just having someone like that being a proponent and being a strong image here would be a game changer and significantly change the landscape and actually make Milwaukee a contender in the filmmaking arts community globally. And I think that's something that would be really great. We don't really have anyone that comes to mind currently. I mean, John Ridley is from Milwaukee. He won an Oscar last year for writing 12 Years a Slave, and he just came out with Jimmy, All Is By My Side, which is terrific, terrific filmmaking, but I don't know what his, you know, plan is. And yeah. So, like, I don't know. It's not really his responsibility to do that, but if he wants to, great. You know, but it's just good to have someone that we can say, like, look at this Milwaukee filmmaker, and, like, we can have greatness come from here, and it can come from anywhere in that regard. And I think that's something that would be great to have, but we do not have as of yet.
It just seems like a lot of maybe small or medium obstacles that are adding up to something big. What is it that your organization is trying to do, since we don't have tax incentives, we don't really have a kind of a well-known booster who makes films here that raises the image profile? What is it that your organization, do you think, can do, and others?
I mean, the main thing that Milwaukee filmmaking needs is money. And I mean, what we need is ability for the filmmakers to do their art form and not have to worry about making the money, because they are creative-minded people, just like dancers and artists and all those people. And they already have all that structure built in for them, where they have business people operating at their behalf so that they can just focus on doing their art form. And that's something that we are unable to do currently. And that's something that I'm trying to fix by being that facet that any filmmaker can go to, and they can consult with me and talk to me about any sort of issues that they're having from a business side or a production side. And primarily what I've been doing is doing trying to secure donations in from local people and sponsorships. So we like partnering with everybody within the community, because filmmaking involves everybody in the community. So whether you're a dancer, an actor, a writer, a singer, a sculpturalist, an engineer, an electrician, there's probably something within the filmmaking community that you would be needed for at some point. And that's something that we were trying to illustrate, is that filmmaking can be an epicenter of all arts. You know, it can be its own art, but also a way of connecting all of the arts and the community together in one sort of medium. And if you're not involved in the process, you can still come and watch the movies and come talk to us about what you might like to see in the future. And we'd like to help do that.
Well, what do you think is going to be happening in the next maybe 5 years in film in Milwaukee? I mean, I went to the Wildwood Film Festival, which is a showcase of Wisconsin filmmaking, and I was really impressed. I think there's a lot going on. There's a lot of talent here. What do you think needs to happen in order for that to progress?
I see where we are at as being very good, but we're still on the precipice before the leap, and we're not quite ready to do it yet, because I can see that we have enough talented people here, and we have all the equipment necessary to do it. And we could really be in sort of a renaissance time if we got a little bit of money. And it's always hard for me to talk about money, because I know it's very hard for people to kind of donate sometimes to an organization that's new and kind of fresh, and they don't know quite who I am or what I'm doing with the money. But all the money that we get goes into filmmaking. Filmmakers are already spending all of their own money and all of their budgets and all their paychecks on these movies, because they just love doing it. And if they just got a little bit of help, even if it's a little bit of free food now and then, is fantastic, or free locations, which we normally get on a regular basis. But it really comes down to that dollar amount, and being able to infuse our talent and take it to the next level with production value. And I think if we were able to do that, I don't know, it's kind of up to the people that aren't really in the filmmaking community to help us out. And I guess that's been the hardest part, is convincing people who are not filmmakers to kind of come on board. And just, you know, if we got fractions of pennies from everybody, we would be doing transformative work.
Well, Sam Cosell, thank you very much for coming on Lake Effect.
Thanks, Dan. It's always great talking to you.
Sam Cosell is president of the Milwaukee-based Film Freed, a nonprofit movie studio. He spoke with Dan Harmon, and you can learn more about his efforts from a link at WUWM.com. One last break, and then a conversation with writer Mark Sloka about his compelling but heartbreaking novel, Brewster. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Now, I'm Mitch Hike. When it comes to the late 1960s, most Americans recall the version that's been written about in the history books, the period of immense social change, the turmoil of political assassinations, the summer of love, the election of Richard Nixon, the legacy of Woodstock. But the 1968 and 69, in which Mark Sloka's latest novel is based, is only a distant cousin of what people think of today. Sloka's book, Brewster, is set in a small city in upstate New York, Brewster, where 1968 still feels a lot like 1964 or 65. It tells of the unlikely friendship between high school track star John Mosher and the school's rebel, Ray Capiciano, and the difficult home circumstances they both inhabit. Mark Sloka visited us in the studio on a recent stop in Milwaukee. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start by mentioning that I finished this book at about 10:30 p.m. and it dawns on me that this is not the book you want to finish at 10:30 p.m. I felt like I had to go watch the Andy Griffith Show or something like that. It packs a punch.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, I'll take that as a compliment. And yeah, Andy Griffith might make up for it. It's not an easy read, I guess. You know, it takes on some pretty dark territory. I mean, it's a book about friendship at bottom, but that friendship comes under a lot of pressure.
One of the things that hit me most in reading the book, and a lot hit me, is that it paints a much less romanticized picture of 1968 and 69 than we often are exposed to so many years later.
Yeah, I think it does. From the way I see it, I suppose, I think the 1960s weren't just one thing. They were two or three, depending on who you were, on the class you came from. You know, my kids are working class kids. So when Woodstock comes around, they don't go to Woodstock because they can't afford to go to Woodstock.
Or they went to Yonkers.
They go to Yonkers, which is almost as good as going to Woodstock, but not quite. Because, you know, they couldn't afford it. They didn't know that they'd let everybody in for free, or, you know, mom and dad wouldn't lend them the car, or mom and dad didn't have a car. So I wanted to write about the 60s and have the 60s happening around them. But it's as though they're hearing, you know, something happening at a great distance and they're just picking up bits and pieces of it.
Right. The Jimi Hendrix and Jefferson Airplane and Country Joe and the Fish, they're on the radio.
Absolutely. And, you know, somebody buys an album and they sit around all night listening to Blonde on Blonde or something and, you know, that's the 60s. Yeah, it's all there.
It seems like it's interesting to think of how the changing times were reflected differently in a place like Brewster. While not far away, such watershed things are going on. And that really, you know, it's like the same planet but different worlds.
Yeah, yeah. And I tried to tap into that. I think I have my narrator say sort of early on, you know, we saw them coming through, you know, these people with guitars on their backs, you know, and their thumb out, you know, waiting for a ride. But they kept going. They didn't stop in Brewster. Why would they? I think that's still true of Brewster today, but that's another issue. I think it must have been interesting for people growing up in places like Brewster to know that this is happening, that, you know, Watts is happening, that, you know, all kinds of things are occurring. But you're still in 1963 or 62. I mean, the racism, the whole nine yards is still occurring around you. You're in this box. But things are outside of that box are becoming more audible.
You live in Brewster today, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Did you grow up there?
I grew up around there, yeah. And then I bounced around. I mean, I lived in Chicago for a while, in New York for a while, in San Diego for a while, Prague out in Europe for a while. And God help me, I came back to Brewster with my wife and kids. You know, we come back around, I think, to places we know, for better or worse.
Well, and I don't know exactly your age, but I'm wondering if your experience
–
so, yeah. So you would have been
10,
11 around the time of Woodstock?
Yeah. Yeah. I was – in a way, I think that was a real good thing for me because I was just on the outside enough that I was able to write about it, which I think is exactly where you want to be as a writer. You don't want to be in the middle. You want to be on the outside looking in. I think that's what most writers do, whatever they're writing about.
Aside from setting, what sparked this story for you?
Coming to terms with my own past, with my family history to a great extent. You know, my parents were Czech refugees. My mother was pretty much broken by the time I was 10. I didn't actually realize until I finished the novel that what I'd managed to do unconsciously was sort of cut myself in two for the sake of the novel. That is, there's a younger brother, idealized brother who dies. The older brother lives on in the shadow of that death. I didn't have an older brother, but I had an idealized younger self that died as far as she was concerned. And I spent the next 20 years standing in front of her saying, I'm right here. I'm the same person. And she couldn't see that. And I think – so there was a lot of kind of heavy lifting that this novel needed to do. And it came at the time when it came and, I wrote what I did.
John is your narrator.
Yeah.
And his mother was broken due to the death of this older sibling. And also, it seems like due to some, I guess the word is survivor's guilt from—
Absolutely. My parents were not camp survivors, but they survived their own horrors. You know, my dad had to cover the hangings as a 21-year-old journalist in Brno, Czechoslovakia. And what that did to him, I'll never know completely, but it was just buried away. Anyone who lives through a seven-year period like that is going to have some ghosts. They had more than their share, I think.
What is the significance of John's telling this story so many years later? Is this you? I mean, do you see yourself not necessarily as John throughout the book, but in the place of John telling the story as an adult processing this stuff?
I mean, John is autobiographical to a great extent. I mean, and sort of Mom in the book is based on Mom and Life, and the character of Ray Capiciano, his friend, is a kind of a combination of two very close friends that I had when I was growing up. I was interested in what I think of as decency under pressure. I mean, these are both decent kids at bottom, and they're under ungodly pressure, which is not of their own making, that they don't deserve. But somehow their friendship, for a time at least, is able to provide some sort of a sanctuary for each of them. And I guess I've always been interested in the notion of justice. I mean, it's a recurrent thing for me, which of course feeds into the 60s as well. Sure. All of these things are coming together, and they allowed me to sort of explore what is just and unjust in family dynamics, you know, how friendship can help with the injustices and so on, yeah.
The friendship between them, really, they get things out of that friendship that they would have expected under other circumstances to get from family.
Yeah. Yeah, and each of them in their own way can't get it from family. I mean, they're coming from essentially abusive relationships, each in their own right. And the third character in the book, Karen, who ends up being sort of the love interest for Ray Capiciano, is in some ways the strongest character in the book, but that's also because she can be. She comes from actually a normal family. But yeah, I mean, they're both coming from – they're both broken in different ways, and in a sense, I guess if the metaphor is like a broken bone, I mean the two of them form one whole for a time being. Somehow that spoke to me. That was necessary for me.
Well, and the other thing about Karen as a character is it would have, I imagine, been very easy to fall into the cliche that Karen would have come between them. But so strong is this friendship that John essentially cedes Karen willingly to Ray.
Yeah. I mean, it's that kind of a friendship. And I also think he kind of recognizes an unstoppable force. I mean, these are two people. They're young, but that's fine. They're young people who are meant to be together. And I think John is just intelligent enough and maybe generous enough as a friend to recognize that. And also, he doesn't want to jeopardize the one good thing that he has in his life, which is really his relationship with Ray. So yeah, I tried very hard to sort of make Karen a character who sort of invites the stereotype and then destroys it. I mean, she looks like some hippie cheerleader, but that's until you talk to her and you suddenly realize, wait a minute, you know, there's a whole lot more going on to this in this person. Hopefully I got that right.
And given everything that is happening to these, you know, I want to call them kids on one level. I want to call them young adults on one level, maybe just people. It's amazing how much of their innocence still exists even to the very last moment of their childhood as portrayed in this book.
I'd like to think so. I mean, I wanted it to be that way. It's, you know, decency under pressure, innocence under pressure. I mean, I think the two sort of go together. I mean, these are – I mean, Ray, for all of his – I mean, he's the bad boy. He's the – you know, he's the kid who gets into fights, into a lot of fights. I think most of us have known somebody like that at some time. But what I wanted to do was create a character who is at bottom fundamentally decent and has been given this thing to contend with as – you know, because that's how life works. I mean, you know, the bad stuff doesn't just happen to bad people. It happens to whoever. And how we deal with the things that we've been handed is kind of what makes us who we are.
The story is framed in some large part by John's involvement on his school's track team. And there's a – I hate to use the word obvious, but I'll use obvious metaphor in his improvement in running races, but ultimately the pain of running races.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting about track because, I mean, I ran track and I think it was a good way of sort of inflicting pain on yourself, which is probably what I was trying to do out of some sense of guilt or anger or whatever it is. And John is very much in that camp. But I also think that the track spoke to the 60s. In the late 1960s, it was sort of a – it was the go-to sport for you know, the kids with an attitude, the rebels, the kids who weren't going to take a lot of stuff from the football coach yelling at them.
It's pretty egalitarian in some ways.
It's really egalitarian and very individualistic. I mean, to a fault sometimes. You're alone a lot when you're training. And so I sort of tapped into that because it was that's where guys like John went in the late 60s.
And, you know, obviously we don't want to give things away, but there's one point, the nightmare that John has about running really stuck with me even after so many other things happened in the book. Just this this image of him running and there being no one there and, you know, essentially to me it seems like the understanding that life goes on whether or not there's an audience.
Yeah. Well, it's that, and I also think somewhere underneath it all, I mean, the ideal metaphor is the kind that doesn't call attention to itself, right, and where you can't sort of line up everything. But it does occur to me that one of the things about running track is that he's trying to escape. He's trying to run away from all the things that he's had to deal with, but he's going in a circle. I mean, when you run track, you go in circles. And I actually had in an early draft of the book, I had him say something along the lines of, you know, I was better at coming around to where I'd started than anybody I'd ever met. And that's kind of the trap he's in. It's like, you know, and Ray, who's an abused kid, comes home every night and he's going in circles.
Right. Ray is obviously running or trying to run. But
Ray is trying to run and he can't because he's held back by his younger brother who he loves, you know, and so he's going in circles. So it seemed to fit.
Do you blanch at the idea of men's fiction?
No. I mean, I don't – you know, even like young adult fiction, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what that is and where the line is. I didn't write this as a young adult book, and then people started saying, oh, you've written a good young adult book.
So I was surprised at that. Yeah.
Maybe I did. I wrote a book for adults that just happened to be about 17 and 18-year-old kids. I've met, you know, 50-year-olds who are children, and I've met, you know, 15-year-olds who are really not. And I know that, yeah, you're younger when you're 15 than 50. But, you know, I just talked to a great bunch of kids out here at Nicolet High School, I guess it is. I mean, they're terrific, terrific kids. And some of them were kids and some of them really weren't. And so in the same way I feel about sort of men's fiction or women's fiction, I mean, for some reason, more of my readers seem to be women. But maybe that's because more women are reading fiction now. I don't know the answer to that. I would think that this is a book that would talk to men. I would hope that it's a book that speaks to women as well. I mean,
friendship is friendship, really.
That's kind of how I would, and love is love. And, you know, the hardship that we have to overcome is universal. So
it's interesting hearing you talk about talking to younger readers.
Yeah.
It's interesting just thinking, you know, I'm some years out from being a teenager and understanding all the things that, you know, as we were processing them then, how they line up with our understanding of them today. Does it surprise you how younger readers relate to what's happening in this book?
I guess it would be sort of, I don't know, self-deprecating or something to say it surprises me. But honestly, it doesn't because, first of all, I think there's a certain nostalgia among a lot of kids today for, you know, for the late 1960s, for the era before computers, before cell phones, before all the rest of it, because it seems purer, simpler. And I think it was in some ways. You know, though both of those words are kind of tricky, like pure, really? How? Simpler? Maybe unmediated is kind of a fancy word for it. I mean, you were kind of in the moment instead of
– less self-conscious.
Less self-conscious, you know. You couldn't take a selfie. I think it's a story about if I got it right, and that's really not for me to say, but if I did – then it's a story that speaks to friendship and friendships that form when you're 17, like love that happens when you're 17, kind of tends to burn very hot. And that's a kind of very privileged place for me to be as a writer and to try to get that right without sentimentalizing it, without romanticizing it in some way. So ideally it'll speak to – as it seemed to today. I mean, the students seem really receptive. It'll just speak to something they know, something that they've experienced in a book that's not talking down to them.
Do you see Brewster, the place today, any differently for having set fiction there and kind of recreated the Brewster of your youth?
Brewster, I mean, I make jokes about it being the Paris of Putnam County. It's a rough little place. It's got sharp elbows. It's still very conservative in certain ways that are not so great. It's a kind of a pocket, and I think it was very much a pocket in the 1960s. Things were happening outside, but Brewster wasn't part of them. I expected to get hear a lot of stuff from local Brewsterites, and in fact, it's been the opposite. I mean, they actually – I've had a lot of older people who've lived in Brewster for many decades come up to me and say, man, you got it right. And I was really flattered by that. I thought, okay, thank you. That's because it's not the kindest portrait. And for them to be able to say you got it right is kind of selfless as well. So that's neat.
Well, it's good, powerful stuff. Mark Sloka, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mark Sloka's recent novel is called Brewster, published by W.W. Norton. He lives in Brewster, New York, and stopped by the Lake Effect Studio on a stop in Milwaukee last month. That's all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you joining us once again today. Hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We are your NPR station in Milwaukee. Coming up in just about an hour's time, it's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, keep listening because it's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.